This is Mark Lemley from Stanford Law School, and you're listening to IP Fridays.
Hello, and welcome to this episode of IP Fridays. Our names are Ken Suzanne and Rolf Clayson, and this is the podcast dedicated to intellectual property. It does not matter where you are from, in-house or private practice, novice or expert. We will help you stay up to date with current topics in the fields of trademarks, patents, design and copyright, discover useful tools, and much more.
Welcome to episode 28 of IP Fridays. Both Ken and I returned home safely from San Diego, where the INTA meeting was held in beginning of May. And we had a fantastic IP Fridays meetup with listeners and also guests on the show. We will try to find some pictures and post them when this episode is published coming Friday. So during this meetup, we tried to gather some ideas for topics that could be part of the future IP Fridays episodes. But we also got a suggestion from our listener, Ed Timberlake, and actually he was also guest on the show a while back. And he suggested that listeners and past guests of the show could actually conduct their own interviews with interesting people in the field of intellectual property and then send it to us, and we would include that into future episodes. So we are very excited about this idea, and maybe before you conduct an interview, let us know so we can talk about the technical infrastructure, you know, what kind of recording devices you use, and to achieve the best possible audio quality. But besides that, we are very happy to have your interviews featured on our show. So feel free to think about this possibility and let us know ahead of time if you want to interview someone, and then we can talk about this. So since Ken and I both attended the INTA meeting in San Diego, we took the chance to have a photo shooting of the two of us. So we are actually posting some pictures to the show notes of this episode. So if you want to see pictures of the two of us, and you can head over to www.ipfridays.com and just go to the show notes of the latest episode. And I will try to work on the cover art and pictures on our different social media channels to update them with the new photos from the two of us. Our interview guest for today's show is Anna Marie Daly. She is partner in the Minneapolis office of Barnes & Thornburg LLP, and she serves as the co-chair of the firm's antitrust and competition law practice group. And since she was frequently involved in IP cases involving foreign parties, she will tell us about the specialties that have to be considered and the trends with these kinds of IP lawsuits involving foreign parties. But before we jump into the interview, I just wanted to let you know that the United States of America and Japan can now be designated in the international design applications of the Hague system. As you might know from the episode of 2 weeks ago, the Hague system, administered by WIPO, allows applicants from all over the world to file design applications in many countries. So you can file one application and designate a multitude of countries and also regions like the EU. And the United States of America and Japan have ratified everything. And as of May 13, so 2 days before you can hear this, it is possible to designate these two new countries, which are probably quite significant for many applicants. If you want to learn more about the particular requirements for Hague system applications designating the US, you can tune into the episode of 2 weeks ago where I had the chance to interview Dave Gerg from the USPTO, who is overseeing the efforts of the USPTO joining the Hague Agreement. So, yes, if you want to learn more about the Hague Agreement and in particular the specialties regarding the US, you can listen to the episode of 2 weeks ago, which is episode 27. I also wanted to tell you about a recent case where Apple won a patent case in China. And in this case, Apple was the defendant. Shanghai Zizhen Network Technologies Company had previously claimed that Apple's Siri had copied its own patents. And the technology of this Chinese company is already used by major Chinese telecommunications companies such as China Telecom or China Unicom Hong Kong or China Mobile. So Shanghai Zizhen sued Apple in June 2012 over infringement of their patents, prompting Apple to petition China's State Intellectual Property Office, ZIPO, asking them to invalidate Zizhen's patent for their technology. And on the 27th of April 2015, a Chinese high court has sided with Apple and denied the complaint of Shanghai Zizhen Network Technology. So now this company has appealed and probably they will meet again at the Supreme Court in China. If you want to read more about this, you can go to www.ipfridays.com/Apple in China, all one word, Apple in China. So in the beginning, I promised you a really cool interview with Anna Marie Daly. So without further ado, let's just jump right in.
Ralph, I am joined today by Anna Marie Daly, who is a partner in the Minneapolis office of Barnes & Thornburg, where she serves as co-chair of the firm's antitrust and competition law practice groups and is a member of the litigation and intellectual property law departments. Anna Marie focuses her practice on complex commercial litigation, federal regulatory and intellectual property law matters. She has experience with numerous different industries and areas of law, and she has defended her clients' legal rights in jurisdictions across the United States. Over several decades, Anna Marie has represented clients in federal and state antitrust, consumer protection, deceptive trade practice, and data privacy matters, as well as nationwide class action and intellectual property litigation. She has helped clients secure high-profile verdicts and summary judgments in numerous cases. Ms. Daly received her J.D. cum laude from the University of Minnesota Law School in 1984, where she was a Truman Scholar and completed a judicial externship with the Honorable Suzanne Sedgwick of the Minnesota Court of Appeals. Anna Marie has decades of experience as an intellectual property attorney, and we are honored to have her on this program. Welcome, Anna Marie, to IP Fridays.
Thank you very much, and I'm excited to be here.
Excellent. Anna Marie, in connection with the intellectual property cases that you have litigated, can you tell me if you've seen any trends in the federal court's exercise of jurisdiction over foreign defendants?
Well, I had the opportunity to be involved in a number of intellectual property cases involving foreign companies as defendants or co-defendants or even as plaintiffs. Mm-hmm. And what we are seeing is that the United States Supreme Court has been moving really to restrict the jurisdiction of U.S. courts when it comes to exercising their power to make legal decisions and obtain judgments against foreign corporations. Mm-hmm. And when it comes to intellectual property cases, you think about it from the U.S. perspective, a lot of times products are manufactured abroad by a foreign corporation, and then they might be imported by a distributor or a dealer or even a subsidiary of that foreign corporation. And if you're thinking about filing, for instance, a patent infringement lawsuit, you are interested in trying to gain access to the information about the manufacturing process, the design process, and that information may be held in the hands of that foreign corporation. And so you need to think about the jurisdictional issues and whether or not you will be able to get a U.S. court to exercise jurisdiction over a foreign manufacturer if you decide to bring a lawsuit.
Mm-hmm.
You may not be able to just use an argument that the subsidiary, the U.S. subsidiary that is the marketing arm, provides you with sufficient activities in the home state to exercise, that the court exercise jurisdiction over the foreign corporation. About a year ago, the U.S. Supreme Court unanimously entered a decision in a case entitled Daimler AG versus Bauman. And in that case, the U.S. Supreme Court restricted the jurisdiction of U.S. courts to hear cases brought by foreign plaintiffs against foreign defendants for conduct occurring outside of the U.S. And that decision was consistent with prior decisions where the U.S. court was restricting the jurisdiction of our U.S. courts to exercise jurisdiction. And in particular, the U.S. Supreme Court was concerned about the principles of comity and whether mm-hmm. or not U.S. courts should be exercising that jurisdiction. The decision in the Daimler case was consistent with the court's prior decision in 2011 in the Goodyear Dunlop Tires versus Brown case, where the U.S. Supreme Court stated that for the exercise of general personal jurisdiction over a defendant to be valid, the defendant must be essentially at home in that form, and that courts should be careful in exercising jurisdiction over foreign corporate defendants.
Hmm.
So as you're thinking about whether or not you want to add that foreign entity as another defendant to your case, you need to carefully consider whether or not under these recent U.S. Supreme Court decisions, you're going to be able to obtain jurisdiction over the court, over the foreign corporation. The mere fact that a subsidiary has sizable sales in a particular form will not be sufficient to justify the exercise of general jurisdiction. You're going to need to have a situation where the particular corporation's contacts with the state are so continuous and systematic, as the court has said, mm-hmm. as to render it essentially at home in that state.
Let's talk about service of process, Anna-Marie. How do you go about serving a foreign defendant with process? Are there any challenges, that litigators face?
Well, there are a number of challenges. And, of course, given the global economy that we live in today, it's not uncommon for us to have a foreign entity, foreign corporation, or even a foreign individual involved in a claim that we want to bring here in the U.S. Under our U.S. laws, of course, we are required to effect what's called service of original process against all defendants. And people may not necessarily pay attention to this, but it is very important, especially if you are facing any kind of statute of limitations or latches or estoppel issues. The main international way to obtain service of process is through the Hague Convention on the Service Abroad of Judicial and Extrajudicial Documents, which generally gets referred to and is commonly known as the Hague Convention. That is a treaty that was formulated back in 1964, and the U.S. ratified it in 1967. So it's been around a long time. The purpose of the Hague Convention was to establish a process whereby documents being served abroad could be served under our deemed served under our U.S. rules,
mm-hmm.
and to ensure that defendants that were in foreign jurisdictions would receive actual and timely notice of the lawsuit. There are currently about 63 signatories to the Hague Convention,
mm-hmm.
and although not all of the countries that have agreed to the Hague Convention have agreed to all parts of the Hague Convention. So if you have a foreign corporation in a particular country, you'll want to check to determine whether or not the state, the country in which that foreign corporation is located, is actually a signatory to the Hague Convention. Mm-hmm. And if so, then you'll be able to obtain service under the Hague Convention. There are many very specific requirements to obtain service under the Hague Convention. You need to check the specific rules for each country and make sure you dot your I's and cross your T's and ensure that you have complied with them. For instance, in a number of countries, you are going to be required to translate the complaint or the documents attached to your complaint into the official language of the country in which service is to be attained. You then will provide that document to the designated central authority for that particular country. The central authority then is the entity in that country which would arrange for service in whatever manner is deemed appropriate within that country. And then the certificate of service will actually be provided back to you from that central authority, and you then can file that certificate of service from that particular country's central authority with the U.S. court to as proof of your service of process.
Very interesting. Now, with respect to discovery, you know, once the case...
Can I go back?
Sure.
And there's one more thing that I think is really important to think about when it comes to service of process, and I apologize because I meant to mention this before.
Yeah.
If you have a particular company that exists and can be found in several different countries, you'll want to look at the particular rules for service of process to determine which one might be easiest to attain. But you're also going to want to consider another aspect as you're thinking about which country to obtain service in. And that is the issue of how are you going, if you're successful and you end up with a judgment, but the assets of that foreign corporation or most of the assets of that foreign corporation are located in another country, you'll want to think about whether you should affect your service of process in the particular country where the assets are located or most of the assets are located, and also that the country that will allow you the easiest ability to enforce the judgment.
That's
enforcing
important.
That judgment.
Yeah.
Right. It's very important. So you've got to think about what your objective in the case from the very beginning, and you can't wait to the very end because you can end up with that proverbial worthless piece of paper in the form of a judgment from a U.S. court that becomes completely that you're completely unable to affect and obtain any assets to enforce a judgment against.
Mm-hmm. Now, with respect to discovery, can a party get the same type of broad discovery that is permitted in the United States courts against a foreign defendant?
Well, if the foreign defendant has representatives here in the U.S., then you should be able to obtain discovery against those individuals in the U.S. Under our U.S. rules. However, if the foreign corporation has employees in another country, you may be restricted. There are a number of things to take into consideration in terms of obtaining discovery against foreign corporations, and you need to start planning your discovery efforts early on in the case in order to be able to obtain that information. So for instance, if you have former employees of a foreign corporation that are important to obtain discovery from, your ability to obtain that information will be restricted in a number of ways. And first, you will need to obtain permission from the U.S. court to obtain the discovery through something that's called a letters rogatory or a letter of request. You'll want to work with lawyers in the country where that individual is located or that company is located so that you can ensure that the court order that you receive from the U.S. court will be honored by the court in that foreign country, because you will need to obtain assistance, and I put assistance in its legal manner, from that foreign court in order to obtain the discovery from that foreign individual or from that foreign corporation in the foreign country.
Mm-hmm.
Depending upon these rules can vary in many different ways. The types of questions that you can ask the witness may have to be approved in advance by the court in the foreign country. I've been in matters involving discovery from Japanese companies, third parties, and you are required, you can be required to provide all of your questions in advance. Those questions then would be asked by a Japanese judge in a Japanese court. The particular Japanese judge may or may not feel restricted to the list of questions that are provided and may go off script, per se, ask additional questions or ask follow-on questions. If you're in the UK, the deposition may be conducted or monitored by what we would consider to be a special master in the U.S., and that essentially the special master or judge may ask additional questions. It may be there to actually monitor the process. In addition, in terms of these restrictions, the foreign corporations may have the opportunity to challenge the request from the U.S. court to the foreign court for assistance in obtaining the discovery. So you can end up with a discovery battle in the U.S. in the first instance to obtain the order from the U.S. court permitting the deposition to proceed with the assistance of the foreign court, and then a separate battle in the foreign court about whether or not that U.S. court order will even be honored, or if it's honored, what form it will be honored.
Wow.
And so it can take months, if not a year plus, all of the court proceedings that are necessary in order to proceed forward with these with what we would consider to be pretty standard depositions in the U.S.
Yeah.
And as a result, of course, as you're thinking about your trial, you're going to want to make sure whatever information you obtain is going to be admissible and most useful in for your ultimate trial in the U.S. And so videotaping the deposition can be a very useful tool. You may need to obtain special permission from the foreign court in order to videotape. Additionally, the kind of discovery that we can have in terms of the documents can be very restricted in a number of foreign countries. You are not likely to be able to have the broad range of document requests accompanying the deposition court orders. And there may be limits on the amount of time that can be taken for the deposition as well.
And Anne-Marie, I know that emails often play a key role in discovery, review of the emails as part of the case. What about text messages? We see everyone texting these days. Same rules apply, or are there any challenges in getting text messages or social media chats?
Well, if the foreign corporation is a defendant in the case, they would be, and you've obtained jurisdiction over the foreign corporation and served them with the appropriate process, so they're appropriately before the U.S. court, that you should be able to get discovery of the documents that exist in that foreign corporation's files, except in situations where you may have restrictions in the particular country regarding particular types of information.
Mm-hmm.
There are data privacy acts in various countries, including places like Austria, that could perhaps limit your ability to get access to information. And so you'll, again, want to check with a local lawyer in that country to find out whether or not there are going to be any particular restrictions that apply. You will also want to make sure you address the issue of whether a foreign corporation is going to provide you with a broad discovery in the context of any of the discovery conferences that you have with the U.S. counsel for that foreign corporation in your U.S. case.
Great. Are there any special considerations that one should evaluate as you develop and implement your trial strategy?
We are lucky, I believe, in the U.S. because we have a diverse population, and in many locations, the jury pools come from very diverse groups of people. Mm-hmm. And so as our citizens become more global, I think that the concern that some foreign corporations may have about biases against foreign entities should be abated. On the other hand, I had the opportunity to try a case where two co-defendants were foreign corporations at the same time that the Timothy McVeigh case was being tried back in the late 90s in Denver federal court.
Mm-hmm.
And it was a time, as you can imagine, where there was a lot of pro-American sentiment and concern about anti-American sentiment going on in the courthouse. So it's just something to need to take into consideration the various effects, the various activities that are going on inside and outside of the courtroom as you prepare for your trial.
Mm-hmm. And then finally, as we draw to a close this interview, can you tell me, once you get the judgment in a U.S. court, how do you actually enforce that judgment if the assets needed to satisfy the judgment are located in a foreign country?
It can be very difficult. You'll want to determine whether or not the country that has the assets from the foreign corporation has signed a treaty with the U.S. to allow for the enforcement of a judgment. You will want to make sure that ultimately the judgment that you obtain from the U.S. court is one that is set forth in a form that will be honored in that particular foreign country.
Mm-hmm.
There is, unfortunately, unlike the Hague Convention, there's no one single treaty or convention that governs the international enforcement of judgments for courts. So it is you really have to evaluate the enforceability of a judgment on a case-by-case basis. And you will be surprised at the various countries in which we, as U.S., have many foreign trade partners from, that you'd think that there would be an agreement between that country and the U.S. to enforce a judgment, and you go out and you do the research, and you find out that there is no such agreement. And so doing that research at the very beginning of your case is going to be critical and should be part of your overall evaluation of whether or not you're going to bring the lawsuit in the first instance.
Anne-Marie, thanks so much for joining us today on IP Fridays. This has been a wonderful interview, and we look forward to speaking with you in the future.
Thanks so much, Ken.
Thank you, Anne-Marie.
That's it for this episode. If you liked what you heard, please show us your love by visiting ipfridays.com/love and tweet a link to this show. We would be so grateful if you would do that. It would help us out to get the word out. Also, please subscribe to our podcast at ipfridays.com or on iTunes or stitcher.com. If you have a question or want to be featured in one of the upcoming episodes, please send us your feedback at ipfridays.com/feedback. Also, please leave us a review on iTunes. You can go to ipfridays.com/iTunes, and it will take you right to the correct page on iTunes. If you want to get mentioned on this podcast or even have comments within the next episode, please leave us your voicemail at ipfridays.com/voicemail. You have been listening to an episode of IP Fridays. The views expressed by the participants of this program are their own and do not represent the views of, nor are they endorsed by, their respective law firms. None of the content should be considered legal advice. The IP Fridays podcast should not be construed as legal advice or legal opinion on any specific facts or circumstances. The contents of this podcast are intended for general informational purposes only, and you are urged to consult your own lawyer on any specific legal questions. As always, consult a lawyer or patent or trademark attorney. Copyright 2014, all rights reserved.